This is joint work with Thomas Vidic and Tina Zahn. And it's about zero knowledge arguments and proofs for QMA. In particular, what I will show is a non-interactive zero knowledge argument for QMA with an instance independent pre-processing step, which consists of a single message from the verifier to the prover. And so, sort of for those of you who are unfamiliar with the jargon, the meaning of this will hopefully become clear soon. So I want to start with sort of a brief overview of this technical jargon. So, let's see. Yeah, there you go. So first of all, what is a proof system for an NP problem? Well, this is best explained via an example. So consider the NP complete problem graph tree coloring. In this problem, you're given as an instance a graph, and you have to decide whether it is tricolorable or not. And a tricoloring is just an assignment of each of the vertices to one of three colors in such a way that no neighboring vertices have the same color. And a proof system for this problem is just an interactive protocol between a computationally bounded verifier and an all-powerful prover, at the end of which the verifier either accepts or rejects. And we require that if a tricoloring exists, so X is a yes instance, then the verifier accepts with probability one, and this condition is called completeness. And if a tricoloring does not exist, so X is a no instance, then for any possibly malicious prover P star that deviates from the honest protocol, the probability of the verifier accepting should be bounded away from one. And this condition is called soundness. Now, if the soundness, so the latter statement holds only for computationally bounded provers, then we call the protocol an argument system rather than a proof system. And so now the sort of a trivial proof system for graph tricoloring is the following. You know, if the graph has a tricoloring, the prover simply sends the tricoloring to the verifier, and the verifier can, of course, efficiently check that the tricoloring is valid. And a very well-studied property of proof systems is called zero knowledge. Now, a proof system is zero knowledge if the interaction between the verifier and the prover doesn't reveal anything more to the verifier other than the fact that the problem is a yes instance. So concretely, in the case of graph tricoloring, the verifier shouldn't learn anything from the interaction beyond the fact that the tricoloring exists. So if we number the vertices in the graph, here is a sketch of the zero knowledge protocol for graph tricoloring. So assume that a tricoloring exists for this graph and the prover knows this tricoloring. So the protocol goes like this. You know, the prover doesn't send the tricoloring in the clear as it did earlier. Instead, the prover sends a cryptographic commitment to a choice of a color for each vertex. And you can think of the commitment as sort of a safe in which a prover puts information about the color of each vertex. And this safe serves two purposes. It hides the content inside from the verifier, and it prevents the prover from changing its mind about the colors. So at the latter stage, the prover can sort of provide keys to the verifier, so some opening information, so that the verifier can open the safe and look at the committed colors. And so the next step in the protocol is that the verifier, after receiving the commitment, samples a uniformly random edge in the graph, say 3, 4, and in this case, and sends this as a challenge to the prover. And the prover just responds with keys to open specifically the committed colors corresponding to the edge 3, 4. And the verifier just checks that the previously committed colors for 3 and 4 are different. And if so, it accepts. And so intuitively, this proof system is zero knowledge because the commitment is hiding, right? And so all that the verifier ever sees is just two distinct colors, which she could have generated on her own. And so on the other hand, soundness in the protocol comes from the fact that if the graph does not have a tricoloring, then at least with some probability, the verifier will ask the prover to open neighboring vertices that have the same committed column. Okay, so this zero knowledge protocol that that I just showed you involved some interaction. So the verifier first received a commitment, then sent a challenge and received a response. Now, what about proof systems without interaction? Where by this, I mean that the protocol consists just of a single message from the prover to the verifier. And it turns out that non-interactive zero knowledge proofs are well studied in the classical literature. And they're often very useful in practical settings. And it is well known that in the plain model, these are impossible to achieve for languages outside of BPP. And one of the most sort of common setups to overcome this and to get non-interactive zero knowledge proofs for all of NP, and I'll use the acronym sort of NISIC to refer to non-interactive zero knowledge. So one way to get this for all of NP is to assume that the verifier and the prover share what is known as a common random string or common reference string, which is generated by a trusted third party. This is the model in which you can get NISICs. And this work in particular is about the quantum setting, okay? So in the quantum setting, the first question that we can ask is sort of, are our proofs for NP, even the interactive ones, still sound and zero knowledge? In particular, for instance, what happens when we have a quantum verifier? Does the proof system still remain zero knowledge? And the difficulty is that in the quantum case, it is not in general possible to rewind the verifier. So in general, a quantum measurement destroys the internal state of the verifier in an irreversible way. Also, quantum information cannot be copied. And so if you are a little bit familiar with the topic of zero knowledge, you'll remember that sort of rewinding the verifier is a common classical technique for proving the zero knowledge property. Nonetheless, you know, we do have interactive zero knowledge proofs for NP, which are sound, which are sort of zero knowledge against quantum verifiers. This is from a work of Watrous. And in the non-interactive case, instead, in a recent work by Perkert and Sheehan, they showed that NISICs for NP can be constructed from the learning with errors assumption in this common random string model. So in our work, one of the things that we show along the way is that these NISICs from Perkert and Sheehan are also straightforwardly post-quantum secure. And this is because just no rewinding of the verifier is involved. And a second direction that you can explore in the quantum setting, which is the one that I'll explore today, is to go beyond NP. So can we have zero knowledge proofs for QMA? And now QMA is just the quantum analog of NP or MA, where the witness is allowed to be the quantum state and the verifier is quantum polynomial time. And the most well studied QMA complete problem is this local Hamiltonian problem, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And so just very briefly, you know, the input is a classical description of a Hamiltonian, which is a Hermitian operator on say n qubits. It is the sum of polynomially many in n local terms. And these terms are local in the sense that they each act on a constant number of qubits. And this is a promise problem. So you're promised that the lowest energy, the lowest eigenvalue of H is either less than alpha or greater than beta. Formally, alpha and beta are part of the input. And there is a gap between alpha and beta, say inverse polynomial, and you have to decide which is the case. And so for simplicity, we can assume that alpha is negligibly close to zero, beta is inverse polynomial. And this problem is in QMA because it's easy sort of to verify that the energy is lower than alpha if you are handed the ground state. But of course, the ground state itself may be hard to find. And here is just a simple QMA protocol for this problem, which does not require the verifier to measure the energy with respect to the whole Hamiltonian, but just with respect to one of the local terms, because this can be measured efficiently. So this is the protocol. The prover sends the ground state, And then the verifier samples uniformly at random one of the terms of the Hamiltonian, measures the energy with respect to this term, and then accepts if the energy is low. And to be a little bit more concrete, you know, let's assume that all of these terms CR are projections, not necessarily orthogonal. Then the measurement that the verifier makes is the one specified by the projection CR and identity minus CR. And the verifier accepts if the outcome is the latter. And so you can think of the terms CR as basically giving an energy penalty to any state that has weight sort of on the range of CR. And in a way, this local Hamiltonian problem and this protocol here, they resemble the graph decoloring problem and the protocol that I described earlier, where you can kind of think of each of the CR as adding a constraint, kind of like the constraint of neighboring edges having different colors, and the verifier just checks one of the edges, so one of the terms in the Hamiltonian. And so it turns out that there is also an interactive zero knowledge protocol for QMA. And this was proposed by Brodmann, G, Song, and Watros in 2016. And in particular, this is a protocol for a variant of the local Hamiltonian problem. And here I'll just give you a very high level sketch of how this protocol proceeds. So you know, let's say that we are in the case of a yes instance. And so there is some ground state. So the first step is the prover will send to the verifier sort of not the ground state in the clear, like it did before. Instead, the prover sends to the verifier an encoding under some authentication code or encryption, without being too precise for the moment, of the witness, the ground state, together with a classical commitment to the encoding key, call it K. And this is a classical key and a classical commitment. And in step two, the verifier samples uniformly at random one of the terms of the Hamiltonian and measures the energy of the encoded state that she received kind of homomorphically and gets a classical encoded outcome. And here by homomorphically, I mean that the encoding, which I'll describe it to you in more detail soon. So the encoding supports computation on the encoded data. So it's possible for the verifier to compute on the encoded data and obtain a classical encoded outcome. And this classical outcome should be an encoding of a low energy outcome if the encoded state was a ground state, otherwise not. And so this encoding is returned by the verifier to the prover, let's call it Z tilde, together with the choice of the term R. And in step three, the prover checks the validity of Z tilde using the authentication property. And don't, again, don't worry about this authentication too much. I'll say more about it later. But if Z tilde is valid, the prover then goes ahead and proves to the verifier that the encoded outcome decodes to a low energy outcome with respect to the previously committed key K. And P does this by engaging in a zero knowledge proof for an NP statement. And the NP statement is basically that there exists opening information for the commitment sent earlier, such that the committed key, K, makes this encoded outcome Z tilde decode to low energy. So we're in a way kind of reducing zero knowledge for zero knowledge proofs for QMA to zero knowledge proofs for NP. And now intuitively, the reason why this protocol is zero knowledge is that the verifier only gets an encoding, an encryption sort of the ground state in step one, which is hiding, together with a commitment to the encoding key, which is also hiding. And the proof that the verifier gets in step three is also zero knowledge. And moreover, this authentication property ensures that the verifier is exclusively getting information about the energy with respect to CR and nothing more. And I guess it should also be kind of at least intuitively clear at a very high level that the prover can't be accepted with probability one unless he truly encodes a ground state. So does this sketch kind of make sense? Maybe this is a good point to stop to see if there are questions. So I will go into more details about the various elements of this protocol soon, because our protocol builds on this. But at least I want to make sure that at the high level it makes sense for now. Okay. So then the question that we solve in this work is how to make this protocol non-interactive. So rather non-interactive with say this an instance independent pre-processing step. So you're allowed to do things that are sort of, that don't depend on the instance, but then once the instance is revealed, there's just one message from the prover to the verifier. And before kind of taking the time to go into more details, let me just start with some high level considerations. So the first one is that certainly step three can be made non-interactive by adding a common random string to the setup and using a non-interactive zero knowledge proof for NP, which is post-quantum secure. Hold on, there you go. Like the one from Packard and Sheehan that I mentioned earlier. And so even after you do this replacement, there is of course still some interaction left. And the crux is really step two, where the verifier is reporting this encoded outcome z tilde to the prover. And so kind of the first thought that you might have of how can we get rid of this message from the verifier to the prover is that maybe the prover can predict this encoded outcome z tilde, or at least send proofs for all possible outcomes in advance so that the verifier doesn't need to send this message. However, unfortunately, you know, because of the requirements of the authentication code, which maybe I'll say more later, this encoded outcome is actually uniformly random one out of exponentially many. And so it cannot be predicted by the prover, and the prover can't possibly send proofs for all possible outcomes, at least not efficiently. And so here is the main idea that I want to explore and then convey in this talk. So the main idea, kind of, it sounds a bit odd, is to swap the order of steps one and two and have the verifier kind of measure the encoded state before she receives it. And it sounds a bit odd, but you know, bear with me. So basically, once you swap the order of the two steps, the two messages of the prover can be merged into one because they are consecutive at that point. And so this basically becomes just a two message protocol. And from there, the first message of the verifier can also be made instance independent. So that way, what we get in the end is a non-interactive protocol preceded by one instance independent message. And the main principle that we will sort of use to realize this idea is quantum teleportation. And so as I mentioned, this will allow the verifier to kind of measure the encoded state before she even gets it and to report the encoded outcome in this pre-processing step, which is instance independent. And the witness will only be actually teleported by the prover to the verifier in the following step. And so in order for this teleportation to be possible, the verifier will have to send enough EPR pairs to the prover in the pre-processing step. And we'll also make use of homomorphic encryption. And this is why, this is why what we get in the end is an argument system instead of a proof system. It's only sound against computationally bounded provers. So this is just a sort of an overview of what to expect or what I'll focus on in the rest of the talk. what I'll do next is I'll have a closer look at the main elements of the protocol. But maybe let me pause first again. I'll give you a chance to ask questions if there's anything.
I have a question, Andre.
So
in the classical protocol that you're mentioning using bit commitment, mm-hmm. the bit commitment possible with, you know, bounded verifier and unbounded rule?
Yes, so it's so you can so for a cryptographic commitment, you can either have it be computationally hiding and statistically binding, or you can have it the other way around, statistically hiding and computationally binding. So in this case, if you want to have a proof system, you'll have to be sort of statistically binding. So the prover, even unbound, the prover can't change his mind. But it's sufficient to have like computationally hiding because the verifier is just polynomial time.
Thanks.
Okay, so,
Hello, hi, sorry. I have more of a basic question in what's mm-hmm. happening in the second step of the protocol in the interactive version. Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you just explain what's happening in the second step? Yeah.
So this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Sure. So let me back up to, so in the first step, right? The prover is sending the ground state, but not in the clear because that would not be zero knowledge. So it's encoded under some encoding, and I'll say a bit more soon about this encoding. And this encoding also has like a secret key. It's a classical key, and so the prover also provides a commitment to this encoding key. Now, in the second step, the verifier samples one of the terms of the Hamiltonian at random and sort of measures the energy with respect to this Hamiltonian. Now, it's not clear, you know, if the verifier had gotten the ground state in the clear, she could just measure the energy in the clear. But now, because the verifier only got an encoding of the ground state, you need this encoding to have an extra property. And the extra property is that you can compute on the encoded data. So basically what the verifier does is she will measure the energy with respect to this term that she sampled, CR, but she will do so sort of on the encoded data and get an encoded outcome. So if the verifier had the key K, she could sort of decode the outcome and learn that it's low energy, but crucially she does not. So she only gets an encoded outcome. She sends this encoded outcome to the prover. And then what the prover does in the end is proof, sort of proof to the verifier that the committed key and the encoded outcome decode to low energy.
So the prover is just doing the decoding because the verifier does not know what the key is. Is that it?
Exactly. So, but crucially, the prover is proving that if you were to decode, using the key committed in this commitment, right? This would, the Z tilde that the verifier sent back would decode to low energy. But crucially, this proof is zero knowledge. So the verifier does not learn anything beyond the fact that this is true, that if you use the key committed in the commitment to decode Z tilde, the answer would be yes, it's a low, you know, it's a low energy outcome. Yes.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks a lot. Yeah.
No problem. Good. Okay. So then basically the main ingredients in our protocol are sort of a variant of the local Hamiltonian problem that is sort of introduced in the same protocol by Broadbent and co-authors. This is called the local Clifford Hamiltonian problem. And the other main ingredients, as I mentioned, are the encoding and quantum teleportation. And at the end, we'll see how they sort of all fit together. And as I cover these elements in more detail, I will go back to the sketch of the protocol on the previous slide, and I'll update the elements there to show you how they're changing, basically. So the local Clifford Hamiltonian problem is a variant, the local Hamiltonian problem. It is the same, except that the local terms have a special form. They are rank one projectors of the form CR, projection onto zero to the K, CR star, where the CRs are K-qubit Clifford operators. So otherwise the problem is the same as before. And even with this restriction, this problem was shown to be QMA complete in the same paper by Broadbent and co-authors. And also, just that we're all on the same page, a Clifford operator on say n qubits is an operator that conjugates Paulis to Paulis. So to be precise, an n qubit operator C is Clifford if for any n bit strings A and B, the equation here holds for some n bit strings A prime and B prime. Where here, when I wrote x to the a, I mean applying x or not on the ith qubit, depending on the value of the ith bit of a. So if the ith bit is one, there is a Pauli x, otherwise there's an identity. And similarly for z to the b. And so in particular, the way in which we'll use this property about Cliffords is that we'll be able to commute a Clifford past an operator of the form x to the a, z to the b, up to changing the exponents. And in particular, the new exponents A prime and B prime, they are efficiently computable once you fix C and the previous exponents A and B. But for now, sort of the one thing that you should remember is simply that the Cliffords commute with the XA C to the B, basically. And so then the following is a simple QMA protocol for the local Clifford Hamiltonian problem, in which the verifier only needs to be able to apply Clifford gates. All right, so this is not a zero knowledge protocol, just a QMA protocol. It goes like this. The prover sends the ground state. The verifier samples, just like before, one of the terms of the Hamiltonian uniformly at random. And then the verifier does the measurement that checks whether the state received from the prover is in the range of this projector CR, zero to the K CR star, or it is in the orthogonal complement. And this can be done equivalently by applying CR star, the inverse of CR, and then measuring the K qubits on which CR acts in the standard basis. And just basically checking if the result is zero to the K or not. And here the verifier accepts if the result is not zero to the K. Right, so recall that CR zero to the K is the term that incurs the energy penalty. So you want to be different than that. And so basically, you know, with these new details, we can go back to the protocol that we had before and make a few changes, which I have highlighted. So now the Hamiltonian is a Clifford Hamiltonian. And just to recap what is going on here, right? In step one, the prover is sending an encoding of the ground state and commitment to the encoding key. Step two, the verifier applies CR star kind of homomorphically on the encoded data and measures, returns the encoded outcome, Z tilde, to the prover together with the choice of the term. And the prover just checks that the encoded outcome is valid. And if so, the prover will send back a non-interactive zero knowledge proof that this outcome decodes to something different than zero to the K. Does this new sketch make sense? I'm going to pause for a moment for questions. Okay, good. So now let's look a bit more closely at the encoding. So I won't describe exactly what the encoding is in the interest of time, but I think sort of this level of detail will be sufficient. So I'll basically just describe the main properties that we need out of this encoding. So the encoding takes a key K, as we mentioned earlier, and it maps one qubit to L qubits, where L is just some parameter, which in our protocol we'll take to be sort of polynomial in N. And the first important property of the encoding is that measuring an encoded state in the standard basis reveals up to a negligible probability in L whether the state was a valid encoding under K or not. And this requires knowing K. So basically, if you know K, you can tell if a state is a valid encoding. And the second important property is that it's possible to apply a Clifford homomorphically, so up to a change in the encoding key. So more precisely, let C be a single qubit Clifford and Psi a single qubit state. Then one can apply a logical C by applying C transversally to all of the L physical qubits. This is a very special property of this encoding. So basically applying C to the L to the encoding of Psi results in an encoding of C applied to Psi. And the only thing to notice is that the encoding key has changed. So it's basically a new key, K prime, which can be deterministically and efficiently derived from K and C. And the last property of this authentication of this encoding ANC is the authentication property. And so let C, K, and K prime be related as in the previous property. And then basically authentication says that without knowing the encoding key K, it is hard for someone to turn an encoding under K of a state psi into an encoding under K prime of something that is not C psi. Okay, so basically it's hard to turn it into an encoding under K prime of say C prime of psi, where C prime is any Clifford that is different than C. So essentially what this means is that, so if I know K and I'm expecting you to apply a logical C to an encoded state, then there is nothing else that you're able to apply logically other than C itself without me detecting it, basically. Let me pause also for question. If there's anything that I can clarify, happy to clarify.
I've got a question, Andrea. Is it important here that K prime is a one-way function in a way? Like, is it hard to, should it be hard to infer C from K prime?
Should it be hard to infer C from K prime? No, not necessarily. So basically, C, anyways, is, you can think of it as being known by the verifier. So C is just one of the terms of the Hamiltonian. So C is known to everyone, or at least C will be one of the terms of the Hamiltonian later. So C is public. The key property here is, once the prover hands to the verifier an encoding of psi under K, the prover is expecting to kind of receive back an encoding under C of psi, where C is this public term, is this Hamiltonian term. So the verifier cannot try to obtain something different than C psi, like logically, something that is not C psi. So for example, a malicious verifier could try to learn something about psi by learning the energy of psi with respect to something that is not one of the Hamiltonian terms. This is something that goes beyond what the verifier would have learned through in a zero knowledge protocol. In a zero knowledge protocol, you just learn this, you know, the energy with respect to this term, is it low or not? But the verifier could try to learn the energy with respect to something different than the terms of the Hamiltonian. And so this authentication property is precisely trying to prevent that.
Thanks.
And one question, why is it okay to have K not equal to K prime when C prime equal to C?
When C prime is, yeah, so the reason why K prime is different is just because, I mean, it's due to the fact that there is basically, in this encoding scheme, there's some error correcting scheme and then followed by a one-time pad. And so basically when you apply the Clifford C transversally, the encoding key is the one-time pad keys will change. Basically, the C will commute past the one-time pad. It would be completely fine if they were the same. It's just that for the particular encoding that exists that you're going to use, K prime is different. But the point is, it's different in a way that is entirely predictable given K and C.
Right. Right. Cool. Thanks. Yeah.
Good. Okay, so then basically this is the protocol that we had a few slides back. So the only thing I have changed, which is highlighted, is basically in step two, the verifier applies CR star transversely. It's kind of applying a logical CR star. And the last ingredient that I need to describe is this quantum teleportation. In particular, just to motivate the idea behind using it again, we will use teleportation to basically switch the order of steps one and two, so that the verifier sort of acts on the encoded witness before even receiving it. So in a way, the verifier will pretend that this witness has been teleported to her already, when in reality, it will only be teleported at the following step. And so I think that most of you are, familiar with quantum teleportation, but I just want to briefly review the notation so that we're on the same page. So basically, right, in quantum teleportation, we start with a single qubit state psi on the first register and an EPR pair on registers two and three. By performing a Bell basis measurement on the first two qubits, the result is that the state of the third register becomes x to the a, z to the b psi, where A and B are bits and they're the outcome of the Bell basis measurement. Now, a consequence of this is the following. You know, if before doing the Bell basis measurement, we apply a single qubit unitary U to the third register, then what comes out of the third wire? Well, you know, the Bell basis measurement and application of U, they act on different wires, so the order doesn't matter, they commute. And at this point, the Bell basis measurement is acting first. And so basically, the result will be XA CB psi, followed by an application of the U gate. So all in all, you get U XA CB psi. And we can obviously also add a measurement on the third wire after the application of U. And all that this does is that the third wire will additionally be measured, where here by M, with a subscript ST, I mean just measurement in the standard basis. So this is just to get the notation. So we all agree on the notation. And now we can finally see sort of quantum teleportation in action in the protocol. And so what I'll describe to you here is a two-message protocol for QMA. Precisely, it's a two-message protocol for the local Clifford Hamiltonian problem. And after we have gone through this protocol, the last step will be to make the first message instance independent. But for now, just a regular two-message protocol that is zero knowledge. So here is the protocol. So in step one, the verifier creates a large enough number of EPR pairs. And the exact number of EPR pairs needed is equal to the number of qubits needed to encode the ground state. So this will anyways always be polynomial in the size of the problem. The verifier then sends the second half of each of these pairs to the prover. And then the verifier, just like sort of she did before, samples a uniformly random R, term of the Hamiltonian, applies CR star transversely to her halves of the EPR pairs. And so basically to the physical qubits. So she is kind of pretending that the EPR pairs halves that she kept contain the encoded witness. But you know, notice that this witness has not yet been sent at all. These are just EPR pairs. And so the verifier then measures in the standard basis and the node by Z tilde, again, the outcome of this measurement. And you know, I'm using this box around the qubits to denote that they have been measured. And the verifier sends Z tilde to the prover together with the choice of the term R. Now for step two, I just am copying the states that we had above so that we can see better what's happening. So in step two, the prover receives or computes the witness. Then the prover samples a key K and applies the encoding to the witness. And then the prover teleports this encoded witness to the verifier. And the square boxes here represent Bell-Bass's measurement. So in particular, notice that each EPR pair is being used to teleport one single qubit of the encoded witness. So here A and B are just strings representing these teleportation errors. They have the same length as the number of qubits that are being teleported. And so finally, then P sends these teleportation errors, AB, a commitment to the key K. And as long as Z tilde passes this authentication property, the prover will also send a non-interactive zero knowledge proof that all of this information, so A, B, the committed key, the encoded outcome Z tilde, all of this information decodes to an outcome that is different than zero to the K, meaning a low energy outcome. So in the next few slides, I'll basically dissect what is going on and why this protocol at least satisfies correctness, which I think this protocol looks a bit odd at first. I'll be a bit more precise. First, I guess, let me stop to see if anything that I can clarify. Okay, good. So here basically is what is happening in this protocol from the lens of teleportation. So here, the first two wires are with the prover. The third wire is with the verifier. The prover has prepared the encoding of the witness in the first wire. And so for simplicity, I'm just sort of using a single wire to represent n times l qubits. This is right because the witness has n qubits, and each qubit is encoded into L qubits by the encoding. So total of N times L. And the second and third wire contain N times L EPR pairs. In the second wire, there are the prover's halves. In the third wire, there are the verifier's halves. And so in step one of the protocol that we just saw in the previous slide, the verifier applied CR star transversally to her halves of the EPR pairs, and then measured in the standard basis to get an outcome Z tilde. And it was only in step two that the prover prepared the encoded witness and teleported it by making Bell-Bass's measurements. And here again, denote by A and B, the outcomes of these measurements, and they are bit strings of size N times L. And now, since the actions of the prover and the verifier are on different wires, their actions commute, right? And so what comes out of the third wire? Well, since the Bell-Bass's measurements are acting first, there is a teleportation happening. And so what comes out of the third wire is the encoding of the witness, followed by teleportation errors, followed by a transversal application of CR star, and then a standard basis measurement. Are we all happy with this? I think this is basically the crucial step on how teleportation is used. Mm-hmm. The verifier had prepared EPR pairs, applied CR star transversally, measured what were just halves of EPR pairs. Nonetheless, because of this commutation, what you get on the verifier side is this. And I think.
Yeah, I have a question, sorry. Yeah. You said it's instance independent, but CR star is not instance independent.
Yeah, you're right. So the protocol that I was showing so far was just a regular two message protocol.
Okay.
And then in at the end, I'll tell you how to make it instance independent. But for now, but yeah, good point. So for now, it's very instance dependent. So for now, it's just a two message protocol. Yeah. So basically now, notice that by definition of Clifford, we can commute the CR star L, this transversal application. We can commute it past the Pauli errors up to updating the Pauli errors. So this is a crucial step, which wouldn't work if the Hamiltonian terms were non-Clifford's. So call the new Pauli errors A prime and B prime. And this depends entirely on CR and A, B. And the next thing to notice is that, you know, by the homomorphic property of the encoding, you know, this transversal application of CR star actually results in a logical CR star being applied to the witness. And the only thing is that the encoding is now under a possibly different key, K prime. But again, this key is deterministically derived from K and CR. And the last thing to notice is that, you know, because we are making a standard basis measurement at the end, the Pauli correction Z to the B prime does not affect the distribution of outcomes at all. It's just applying a phase, so we can ignore it. On the other hand, this Pauli X correction, X to the A prime, of course, has an effect. It flips the measurement outcome precisely by XORing with the string A prime. So what we obtain from the third wire is a measurement outcome that is precisely distributed as if we were measuring the correctly encoded state, CR star applied to the witness, except that this outcome is flipped by A prime. Does this make sense? I can also go over it again if it helps. So basically, you know, to recap what has actually happened. So we started by switching the order of the verifier and the prover's action in the original protocol. And we noticed from the last calculation that the distribution of the measurement outcome Z tilde of the verifier, once we switch, is almost identical to what she would have gotten in the original three-round protocol without the switching. So it is simply a measurement of the encoding of CR star applied to the witness, except that this outcome is flipped by A prime. And the crucial part is that this flip A prime can be accounted for in the non-interactive zero knowledge proof that the prover sends in his message. So basically what the prover will prove to the verifier using an ESIC is that this outcome Z tilde obtained by the verifier upon canceling the error A prime decodes to a low energy outcome.
Andrea, I think the correctness is pretty clear. The question is, why is it sound? Like, why couldn't the prover take R and to come up with a different witness that actually does not, like, it is not a low energy state, and then, but because you already get R upfront.
Very good.
Not together to cheat.
Yeah. That's I'm glad that someone mentioned this. So basically, yeah, before I answer your question, let me just first recap, I guess, for everyone, and then I'll get to your question. It's a very good question. So just a recap of what has this two message protocol was. So the verifier prepared enough EPR pairs, send the second half of each pair to the prover, applied CR star transversally to her halves, measured, obtained Z tilde, and send Z tilde and R to the prover. Then the prover sampled the key K, prepared an encoding under K of the witness, teleported the witness, and send the teleportation error, the commitment to K, and an ESIC proof that everything is consistent with low energy. So as Debbie mentioned, this protocol doesn't quite work as is, there is an issue with soundness. So the issue that Debbie pointed out is the more glaring issue, and there's also one more subtle issue. So the more glaring issue is that, I mean, we cannot be telling R to the prover in the clear, because the prover at this point has not yet committed or sent his state. So by knowing R, the prover can just send a state that passes, you know, teleport a state that passes only the CR energy test, but it is not a true ground state, right? So we definitely have to deal with this issue. It's as if in the graph tricoupling protocol, you're told what edge you're going to be challenged on before you have to commit to the colors, basically. So there's actually also one other more subtle issue, even if the problem of revealing R was not present. So the issue is that in the analysis that we just did, we sort of freely commuted the prover's actions with the verifier's actions. Now, this is legitimate if the prover is honest and indeed applies a Bell basis measurement. However, the problem is that in the protocol that we had with two messages, the prover receives Z tilde. Crucially, he receives Z tilde before he has to make his teleportation measurement. So in particular, he could use the knowledge of Z tilde to make a convenient choice of A and B to report back. And the verifiers and the prover's actions, right? Clearly, they don't commute if the prover's actions depend non-trivially on Z tilde, right? Does this other issue make sense? Okay, so basically the solution to the to both of these issues is that the verifier will not send the outcome Z tilde and the choice of R in the clear. Instead, we'll have the verifier send a homomorphic encryption of Z tilde and R. In this way, P does not get to see, right, the choice of R, does not get to correlate his teleportation errors with Z tilde, because crucially, the teleportation errors are required to be sent in the clear. So the teleportation errors are still have to be reported in the clear, but Z tilde and R are homomorphically encrypted.
So, is this what makes this argument system and not a proof system?
Yeah, this is what makes it why you need you're only sound against computationally bounded provers, exactly.
Both verifier and prover have pretty much a similar power. But no.
So the thing is, the prover also gets the witness.
Basically. Yeah, exactly. So prover has some power, right? I mean, of that kind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know, crucially, so even though the prover is not getting Z tilde and R in the clear, you know, the prover still sees everything under the hood of the homomorphic encryption. So the prover is still able to compute the non-interactive zero knowledge proof that he was supposed to compute before. He's just computing it homomorphically, right, on the encoded data. But crucially, he reports the teleportation errors in the clear. And as Anurag mentioned, this is why we downgrade to an argument, so only sound against computationally bounded provers. So basically, the new protocol looks like this. Again, I'm highlighting just the changes. So the verifier is additionally sampling a public key, a secret key pair for a homomorphic encryption scheme. Similarly to before, verifier samples uniformly random R, applies CR star transversely, measures to get Z tilde. And now instead of sending Z tilde and R in the clear, V sends a homomorphic encryption of Z tilde and R together with the sampled public key. And the honest prover acts exactly as before, except that it computes the NAZK proof under the hood of the homomorphic encryption. And so crucially, the prover sends the verifier the encrypted proof, but the errors in the clear. And the verifier decrypts the proof and checks that it is valid, in particular, that it is valid with respect to the teleportation errors that have been reported. Good. So there is basically only one last tweak that we need to take care of, which is namely making the first message instance independent. So currently the first message definitely depends on the instance because the verifier is measuring a term of the Hamiltonian, which is the instance. So let me first just check if there are questions. So I'm almost at the end, before I finish, let me just check for that there are questions.
So I have this, sorry, it's a very basic question. If the prover is able to create the proof, doesn't that already make the prover extremely powerful?
So basically, when you're talking about proof systems and argument system, so if it's a proof system, right, everything's fine, right? If it's an argument system, the way to sort of reason about it is like, you know, I'm a prover, I'm computationally bounded, but I am handed the witness. Like, it's just given to me.
I see. Okay, now, okay.
Can I actually prove to you that it's a yes instance if I'm handed the witness in such a way that if it's a no instance, I can't fool you.
Right.
Being computationally bounded, I can't fool you into thinking that I have a witness, basically.
Okay, okay, I see. So there's a third person who's
just handing you, exactly.
Cool, thanks.
Okay, so just to make the first step instance independent, you know, let's take a step back. You know, what I showed was a two-message protocol for this QMA complete problem, local Clifford Hamiltonian. If we want to get a two-message protocol for any QMA language, what we are doing is the following implicitly. So the verifier and the prover start from an instance X of a QMA problem with verifying circuit Q. They just consider the verifying circuit QX, which has the instance X hard-coded. And then they map this to an instance of the local Clifford Hamiltonian problem. And they do this with sort of a circuit to Hamiltonian reduction. And then they run the two message protocol in which the verifier is checking that the witness has low energy with respect to this Hamiltonian. So this is basically the current approach, which to get proofs for all of QMA, which was kind of implicit. Now, in order to make step one of the protocol instance independent, we will do the following instead. So the verifier at step one only knows the verifying circuit Q for the QMA problem, does the following, still sort of nonetheless applies the circuit to Hamiltonian reduction to get a local Clifford Hamiltonian H of Q, which is instance independent. Now the problem is it is not immediate how one can make the protocol work with this instance independent Hamiltonian. In particular, notice that this Hamiltonian has potentially many low energy states. This corresponds to all of the possible yes instances, not to the specific one that will be made public at step two, basically. However, you know, with a few small modifications, which I guess I won't describe here in the interest of time, but you can ask me, I'm happy to tell you more later. One can still make the protocol work even with this generic Hamiltonian. And basically the verifier just has to do sort of a delayed test for the correctness of the instance. So she doesn't know the instance initially, but she knows it at the time at which she's verifying the non-interactive zero knowledge proof. So at step two, she will know the instance. She sort of does a delayed test for checking the correctness of the instance. That's I mean, a very vague idea, but I can tell you more later if you're interested. And so basically to recap, assuming the learning with errors assumption is true, what we got was a two message argument for QMA in which the first message from the verifier to the prover is instance independent. And now it's a good point to mention two related results, one by Broadbent and Grillo, one by Alagic and co-authors, in which they also get non-interactive zero-knowledge arguments for QMA with preprocessing. In particular, the latter protocol is secure in the random oracle model. And the appeal is that the protocol is completely classical. And the main question that is kind of left open by all of these works is, can we have a truly non-interactive protocol for QMA in the common random string model, or maybe in a model with, say, shared EPR pairs, for example? And if not, can we prove that it's impossible to have one? Yeah, this is all I had. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Andrea, for a really interesting talk.
Thank you.
We had a few questions throughout, but does anyone else have any further questions? So I'd actually like to know a little bit more about the encoding use, which has this kind of Clifford gate property. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, for sure. So basically, the encoding is you take a single qubit, you use an error correcting code. In particular, you can take what is taken here is the concatenated Steen code. Mm-hmm. So you map a single qubit to say N. Or L was the letter I was using, to L qubits. What you do after that is you append a bunch of states in sort of states in a few different bases that sort of say the zero, the plus bases. You do a permutation to all of this, okay, and then on top of sort of this whole big state, you finally do a one-time pad. So to each of the qubits, you apply a random sort of XA, ZB. And so the point of using the concatenated Steen code is that you can apply Clifford's transversally.
Yeah.
It supports sort of transversal application of Clifford's. So if you are to apply a Clifford to sort of this one-time pad of this concatenated Steen code with extra sort of trapped qubits added, what will happen is that the Clifford will commute past the one-time pad after changing the exponents. And then you'll have a transversal Clifford, which sort of becomes a logical Clifford. And if you try to apply, so this is the homomorphic property. Where does the authentication property come from? It comes from the fact that you've added a bunch of other sort of trap qubits that you know in which state they are, and you've kind of permuted them all. And if you want to do something different than what I expect you to do, say a certain C applied to the encoded state, you're going to have to, because the distance is like L over 2, you're going to have to, with very high probability, touch the trap qubits as well. And so I can detect that you've touched the trap qubits, basically. The trap qubits are going to be permuted.
Okay, yeah.
So all of these, yeah, exactly. So if you want to sort of change the logical Clifford that you're applying, you'll have to touch the trap qubits as well. Yeah.
Okay, great. So I don't think we have any more questions, but
wait, Andrew, I actually have one question. So
sure.
Yeah, so in this question that you bring up at the end with the shared EPR pairs, it seems like you're already really close to that with the like input independence. Like it seems like we're already using the fact that we can kind of commute the actions of the verifier and the prover. So I can't I don't really understand this first input independence step. But like, why can't the first step just be like, you know, do exactly what you did in the input, like you've already shared the EPR pairs, and then you know the verifier just does all the same things, and then hopefully by coming to something works out.
Yeah, so crucially, I guess what would be missing is that in the first step, the verifier not only sends half EPR pairs, but is also sending Z tilde, so the encoded outcome. So crucially, the verifier is also measuring her half EPR pairs and sending this classical outcome that she got. So what I would want is a protocol in which, so you just share EPR pairs, and then it's literally just a single message from the prover to the verifier, and that's it. Like right now, the verifier has to crucially send this classical outcomes first, along with the half EPR pairs.
Can the prover not guess what they're going to measure in advance?
I think that the issue with that is that the prover could be dishonest in that case. I think that would be the main issue, basically.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, do we have any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Andrea again.